Are the lawyers and parties here on the fourth case, Urbanek?
Yes, we are.
Okay. The fourth and final matter on the calendar this morning is the matter of the civil commitment of Edward, I'm saying Urbanek, is that correct? Welcome to the Court of Appeals. My name is John Rodenberg. I'm pleased to serve today as presiding judge with Chief Judge Cleary and Judge Larkin. Each of you will have 15 minutes for your principal argument. Appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal if the appellant wishes to use that time. We ask that when you approach the podium, you say your name and the party you represent, even though we know it now. Someone will need to look back and listen to the record later. You can adjust the podium up and down to suit your comfort. Whenever appellant is ready, you may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Jill Avery. I'm an attorney with Templeman Law, and we represent the appellant in this manner pro bono. This case is about our client, Mr. Edward Urbanek, who wasn't in prison, who wasn't under conditional release. Mr. Urbanek had been living and working in the community without reoffending and had successfully completed sex offender treatment during that time. His civil commitment as an SDP then resulted from an admittedly false accusation.
He completed the treatment during custody in the Commissioner of Corrections.
No, he was under conditional release. So after he was released from prison, he was in outpatient treatment for 2.5 years. He drove 60 miles each way, and he paid for it himself. He could have gotten out early, and he elected to stay in there. There are two issues before the court today. The first is whether Mr. Urbanek's civil commitment process was unconstitutional and therefore void, and the second being whether Mr. Urbanek received ineffective counsel. And the answer to both those questions is yes. And at the end of the time today, we ask that you reverse the district court's order denying his 60.02D and 60.02F motions.
Is the relief on either different? In other words, if it's under D, dismiss,
D,
the judgment's void.
D being a void commitment, it would be vacated. And under F, it would be a new trial. But F is a residual clause. So first, you're going to look at D.
Right.
And if D doesn't apply, then you would look at F.
Okay.
Mr. Urbanek's commitment was unconstitutional for multiple reasons. In 2004, Minnesota Statute 253B.185 governed civil commitments of SPP and SDB candidates. The statute stated that upon the submission of facts to the county attorney, the county attorney would file a petition if good cause was determined. These facts would consist of a person's medical and detention data that by law is private unless a statute authorizes its release. When a person is in prison, Minnesota Statute 244.05 authorizes the DOC commissioner to release that type of information after a pre-petition screening and a determination of high risk. But the parties in the court all agree that Mr. Urbanek was not subject to 244.05. He wasn't in prison. He wasn't under conditional release. And the DOC commissioner did not screen him nor refer him. And the district court also wrongly found that we argued that 244.05 was the only manner in which somebody could be referred. What we argued was that if there was no 244.05 referral, that the referral at least had to be legal. What happened to Mr. Urbanek was about 6 weeks after his records were corrected and all of his rights were restored, a member of the End of Confinement Review Committee took his data and mailed it to the Hubbard County Attorney.
Which was not his county of residence.
No, it was not his county of residence. There is no statute that authorized this release, and there is actually a statute, 244.052, which prohibits a member of the End of Confinement Review Committee from releasing data outside the committee.
Counsel, just to be clear, because I haven't gone back and read it, but weren't these arguments raised in the Court of Appeals, the Supreme Court? Okay.
Yes. This illegal release of information cannot be used to invoke a county's attorney's right to act under 253B.185.
If these arguments were raised, why are we hearing them again?
Because they said that it was all constitutional legal.
Okay, so who said that?
The Otter Tail District Court.
Right.
So they denied our motion.
And then there was an appeal.
This is the appeal.
Okay. But in the first case, were these issues raised about the release of records?
No, this is a 60.02 motion. So this was not raised with his original attorney.
Why wasn't it raised back then?
I can only speculate. That is one of our claims about ineffective counsel, is that these issues were not raised. And we've got more. There's more issues that lead to this being an unconstitutional civil conduct.
What authority do you have that says if these records were illegally released, that means the district court was without subject matter jurisdiction to hear the original commitment action?
We're just going on the fact that the statute requires that facts be submitted, and this was illegally released information. You wouldn't have 244.05 statute authorizing the DOC commissioner.
I'm just going to come right to the point. Mm-hmm. Okay. Even if these documents shouldn't have been sent from the commissioner to the county attorney,
right,
and even if the county attorney should not have turned them over to the county attorney in your client's county of residence, what law says those violations means you can't go forward with the commitment hearing?
Well, the statute as written is constitutional. But when you violate the statute, you have to question whether the process is constitutional or not.
I understand that. But you're connecting statutory violations with the conclusion that those violations result in a lack of jurisdiction by the district court.
They didn't have subject matter jurisdiction to hear the case.
What authority do you have to support that?
Just the statute that required facts be submitted.
But we have plenty of case law.
Right.
That says subject matter jurisdiction means a district court's authority to hear a particular type of case.
Right.
And very few cases saying failure to comply with the statutory requirement deprives the court of jurisdiction. And the only ones I can think of are situations where you must do a certain act within a certain period of time, mm-hmm. otherwise the district court cannot act. But I'm not seeing any case law that you've cited that says, you know, if records were released in violation of statute, that means the district court doesn't have jurisdiction to issue a decision based on those records.
Well, they have jurisdiction over when it's been legally released to them, such as 244.05, and they wouldn't have 244.05. Why even have any statute then authorizing the release of records when anybody can do it?
So this would be an issue of first impression where we would hold that if records are released in violation yes. of statute, a district court is without subject matter jurisdiction. Oh,
yes. A lot of
to
items,
consider those records in a commitment proceeding.
Right. A lot of issues in this are of first impression because people that are SPP, SDP candidates are under judicial hold. They're in prison. And he is probably the first one, the only one I've come across that was a free man when he was civilly committed.
But I need some authority. Okay. I just can't say, well, the statute says you must do this, therefore district court has no subject matter yeah. jurisdiction. What's your argument by analogy to some case where the court has said there's no subject matter jurisdiction if there is not compliance with the statutory requirement?
Well, in the case that was cited by the respondent, Henry Geem, where the respondent made a claim that, well, he asked to have a hearing within 5 days, and he didn't get that within 5 days, and they deemed that that was an important part of the statute, that he has a hearing within the required time, and they did vacate his commitment. So you have to, compliance with the statutory language is one of the requirements of being constitutional. This statute has been reviewed for constitutionality. And in Reed Danforth, it said, well, because you've got all these protections in there, it's constitutional. But when you start taking them away, it's no longer constitutional. So 253B.185 is also very specific about which county can act. If a person is not in prison, the only county that can file a petition, that can determine good cause, and can make a motion for additional records, is the county where the person resides. Mr. Urbanek was residing in Otter Tail County, and the person who illegally released his information also mailed it to the wrong county. He mailed it to Hubbard County, and the Hubbard County attorney made a motion without statutory authority to obtain additional records, and the Hubbard County District Court, without jurisdiction, granted that motion. Now, part of the statute also required that a notice be sent to Mr. Urbanek. And that notice was sent to an Otter Tail County address. And the Hubbard County attorney and the court should have noticed that they weren't sending it to a prison address. They weren't sending it to a Hubbard County address, but they were sending it to an Otter Tail County residence, and that should have told them right there they didn't have jurisdiction. This notice also did not go to his latest address on record, and he didn't receive it, but that doesn't matter because the court didn't have jurisdiction and he did not appear.
The court didn't have jurisdiction to do what? Order the release of
records? To do the records, productional records hearing.
And why didn't it have jurisdiction?
The statute requires, it's very specific in which county can act. And if a person is not in prison, it states that the only county that can act is the county of residence. The convicting county can act if he was still in prison. And Mr. Urbanek was not in prison. He was a free man at this point.
But I think you're confusing subject matter jurisdiction, because what you just seem to have said is the county attorney in the conviction county didn't have authority to obtain these records.
Right.
That's a different issue than whether or not the district court in that county had authority to rule on that motion. It may be that the county attorney had no authority to do what he or
right,
she did.
Right.
That's a different question than whether or not the district court had subject matter jurisdiction to rule on the request.
Well, the county attorney would file in his own county district court. And so, yeah, right, the statute does not say they must file only in their county, but, you know, they don't have jurisdiction to file in any county they want.
Okay. But how do you go from an argument that the county attorney was without authority to act under statute to the district court was without authority or jurisdiction?
If Otter Tail County had been the county making the motion for records, they would make that in Otter Tail County. They would not go to Hubbard County and make the motion. It's unfair to Mr. Urbanek, who lived in Otter Tail County.
Okay. I understand your arguments about fairness, but I'm looking for the legal authority that says, you know, the district courts have subject matter jurisdiction over SDP, SPP cases.
Correct.
And that's what subject matter jurisdiction means,
right,
the authority to hear and decide cases. And you're asking, based on all kinds of irregularities at best, statutory violations at worst, for us to say the district court here was without jurisdiction to hold this SDP, SPP commitment hearing.
Well, in this case, when they defined in the statute which county attorney has the authority to act, I think the assumption is that they would only be filing the petition in their own county and not...
And maybe, but how does that result in a conclusion that the district court that held this commitment hearing was without subject matter jurisdiction?
Again, I'm just going to refer back to the statute. So,
okay.
All the parties agree that 244.05 did not apply. And we never argued.
Could you address briefly the timeliness of your motion? I know that was raised below. The district court assumed without deciding that the motions here were timely, and
right,
it's been briefed on appeal.
The motion was raised. Well, Mr. Urbanek got court attention when Mr. Magnus was charged with drug possession.
Mm-hmm.
And up until that point, he had been confined at Moose Lake, and he had no access to money, family, friends. His only representation was Mr. Magnus, who didn't help him identify his errors. He was a conflict of interest. So he had nobody to help him until he was able to get assistance on a 60.02 motion.
But he filed a 60.02 motion pro se. Why didn't he do that 10 years ago?
He did not know. He actually hadn't developed the case. He knew that something was amiss. He knew he shouldn't be there, but he didn't know, he didn't have the legal knowledge to be able to look through the documents. He didn't have access to the documents. He had nothing. And it's hard to develop a case when you have no access to any documents whatsoever. And he's relying on his attorney to help him, and his attorney did not do that. So
it's his original 60.02 motion only asserting ineffective assistance of counsel?
No, we had two motions. The first one being that it's a void judgment under 60.02D.
He made that argument pro se?
No.
His original motion.
That was my question.
Yes.
It was his original motion.
Oh, his original motion was 59 and I think a 60.02.
Based on ineffective assistance of counsel,
mm-hmm,
because his his attorney had been charged with drug possession.
Right.
So
right,
he didn't, that was my point. He didn't make the arguments that you're now making initially.
Correct, until we assisted him. So then we amended the the motion, and then we also filed a second motion for void commitment stuff. So after, so this notice should have put Hubbard County on notice that they didn't have the authority to do so. The notice also did not notify Mr. Bannick that he had the right to counsel. And under 253B, it states that the party under any proceeding has the right to counsel. Now, if he had been in prison, he would have been notified that he had a right to counsel as part of their pre-petition screening process. But because he wasn't, he did not get any notice to that effect either. He did not know about
it. Get the notice at all, did he?
No, he never knew about it until the order on January of 2019 when the district court brought this up. It was not mentioned in any of the exhibits. It was not mentioned in any of the transcripts. There was no mention of this document until we heard about it in the order. Hubbard County District Court then took this illegally obtained information and further released it to two doctors. The information was incomplete. It was misleading. It was erroneous because we have this person from the End of Confinement Review Committee picking and choosing his information. And
on that point, and perhaps you can address it rebuttal, one thing I'm struggling here with is that to me this seems like a case where someone comes in after they've been convicted by a jury beyond a reasonable doubt of a crime and says there was a problem with my probable cause hearing. I mean, and at some point, inaccurate or incomplete information in the documents which led to the petition matter once you've actually had a contested hearing and had an opportunity to test the validity of all of the information at a full hearing.
Right, and one of our claims under the ineffective counsel is that Attorney Magnus didn't make those claims. He did not make a motion to dismiss the petition. He did not make a motion to amend the petition, all the errors that were in the petition. He did not ask the court to stipulate to the correct, the parties to stipulate to the correct facts, and for that reason, two doctors were able to testify that he was under conditional release, that he had multiple violations, and they were able to base their opinions on that. And so that has followed him till this day, and we know that when the girl testified that she said, no, he did not say those things. She had testified that he had made sexually suggestive...
Didn't that all come out at the commitment hearing?
Pardon?
Didn't all that come out at the commitment hearing?
It was discussed.
Okay. So that's my point. It's like the documents that led to the petition were inaccurate or incomplete. But then at trial, they were fleshed out, and there was an opportunity to show, no, the girl didn't
say that.
It
wasn't entirely fleshed.
Here's what actually happened.
Yeah, it wasn't entirely fleshed out, though. And he did make some of the arguments in there. But one of the points that they made the comment in the hold hearing that at that moment, he wasn't under conditional release. But they never went back and said, you shouldn't have been under conditional release since 2002, and these aren't violations. One of the documents at the end of the hearing is that the judge asked the attorneys to submit proposed findings of fact. And Exhibit 42 is Mr. Magnus's, and if you would look at that document, he's not an attorney you would want to hire. And he never once mentioned Jessica Cubbett's changing her story on the stand and saying that he never said those things to her. He never mentioned that the second contact with minors violation was when he was apprehended. He was at his friend's home in the basement. And when they came to get him, they noticed there was a teenage girl and her son in an upstairs bedroom. There was absolutely no contact between them. He did not know they were home at the time. It's possible they came home after he was there downstairs with his friend. And that turned into contact with minors. So those things were just not mentioned. I know I'm out of time. We did make a motion for extra time, and we would like to re-add that motion to add extra time.
Okay, you'll have 5 minutes on rebuttal. We did run over a ways as well.
I did, so I know.
In response to questions, there was nothing wrong with it, but you got a little extra time is what I'm saying. Respondent.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel, I'm Assistant Attorney General Angela Kiza, representing the respondent, Otter Tail County, in this matter. I'm not sure where exactly to start, but the...
Counsel, start with this. How unusual is this in terms of the commencement of a commitment proceeding under these facts?
It's unusual, but it's also unusual that somebody's in prison and suddenly and he was in prison on what was thought to be a release violation on one of the 24405 offenses, and then he was suddenly released. So the county attorney acted as soon as they get information about that sudden release. But it's not that it never happens, it's just unusual that it happens in this way.
So other people who are large are petitioned for commitment?
Other people have been petitioned for commitment who are in the community, yes. It's unusual, but it does happen.
Do you agree that the disclosure of the private data was illegal at the time?
No, I don't agree with that. So under 24405, his conviction did fall under that. It's just that he was released before they got to that, so they informed the county. And they did inform Hubbard County because the statute specifically says to inform the county of conviction. And Hubbard County went forward and actually through our office, so the fact that it went to the Otter Tail County address and that it was still in Hubbard County, the notice was attempted at the address that was had for him. And that is something that, I mean, there's not an adequate record. The court did not rely on that. It's nothing about abuse of discretion for the Rule 60.02 motion, but there's not a transcript of that records hearing. There's not affidavits from whoever in our office did the service to say, you know, where they came up with the address for him, any of that. In fact, his affidavit that he attached to his, in his addendum it was not properly before the district court in this case, and she did not agree to supplement the record with that affidavit. But in any event,
I guess what I'm asking is the May 2004 action by the DOC employee, was that illegal?
No, it was not illegal. The statute specifically provides that the county of conviction gets notice under 24405. Because they didn't go through that process, because it was released early, they sent the information to the county that he had been released early. So, I think they were...
Well, who released him? Released him early? The DOC.
What?
The DOC released him.
Yes, the DOC. Yes.
So it was their mistake to begin with, is what you're saying.
Well, if there was a mistake, it was the DOC's mistake as far as letting the county attorney know. But the statute provides that if they had done that review, which they...
Could you clarify? I thought he was released because a court held that he should not have had a 10-year conditional release. It should be a 5-year conditional release. Therefore, he was ordered released immediately.
Correct.
And therefore, the DOC was complying with court order.
Oh, right. Yeah. I'm sorry. But they're the ones who released him from their custody. But, yeah, that was based on the court order changing the conditional release period. So, essentially, his sentence had expired already.
And the fact is, he was not released early. He was released late, right?
Well, late from the release violation standpoint, yes. He had been out and... So while he thought he was on supervision when he committed the reported violations, technically, I mean, at that point he was because the court hadn't reversed it yet.
Right.
But once the court reversed it, it was clear that that was not.
But he wasn't. DOC did not say, we're going to release him early. DOC kept him longer than they really legally should have under supervision.
Well, they kept him pursuant to the original court order that
Agreed.
Said he had a 10-year conditional release. As soon as the DOC received the order that he had only 5 years conditional release, they did release him. And then because he was somebody who was a high-risk offender, who was reviewed for community notification, who should be reviewed for civil commitment, they let the county attorney know that he had been released because of this court order shortening his discharge period.
But under subdivision 7 of 24405, that process is to be done, quote, before the commissioner releases, right?
Correct, yes.
And is it done before the commissioner released?
No, not this. Not at the time of his release violation. He had a prior one, like back in 98, a prior review where they didn't refer him for commitment. But the more recent, that's part of the thing with this ECRC, with an appellant saying that ECRC is picking and choosing. The ECRC was not, that's the end of confinement review. They set the risk levels. They give notice of that per statute. So they're not the ones picking and choosing what experts get for civil commitment for pre-petition review. That's something that the Hubbard County attorney went before the court, requested the records order. The court found good cause to issue that records order. The county attorney collected that information. The county attorney provided the records to the pre-petition examiners. And then when the county attorney When they supported a petition and they realized he was Otter Tail County's, you know, that was the proper place for the petition to go, it was forwarded over to Otter Tail County.
What was the county attorney's authority for requesting the documents from DOC?
Well, it was 253B185, and under that, and I think at that point it was 1B of that statute. That, you know, that doesn't limit which counties can, which county attorneys can access that information from a, or move for records order. From a practical standpoint, it's going to either be the county of conviction who gets the referral, even though they might not be the county of petition, or it's going to be the county of financial responsibility or the county of residence from a practical standpoint. And oftentimes even the, because the statute says county of conviction, oftentimes it'll go to the wrong county in the first instance, you know, even when the process, the referral is gone through the interview and the whole process is done. So, but in any event, the point that Judge Larkin brought up with the appellant, whatever the irregularities were, those were never, you know, if there were irregularities and how the records were obtained and how they were shared and how they were reviewed, they, that was never challenged. There was never an issue with that before. And his attorney, once the petition was filed, he had an attorney. His attorney did receive all of the records that were the full set of records, and he even obtained several hundred other pages of records that he submitted as part of the case. So at least from the time of the hold hearing, his attorney had all of those records, which was, I think, about 3 months before trial. So he certainly knew of the existence of the records, that the petitioner had obtained the records. You know, if he wanted to make any issue about the fact that those records were had or used in the commitment proceedings, that was the time to make that issue, not now 12 years later or 14 years later. I mean, you know, and that was part of it. The first thing that we point out in our brief is this is over 12 years from the trial in this case. And this is not an unforeseen situation. This is not some unique situation. This is a case where the petition was filed. It was, you know, I think 26 pages long. It was several pages long that had the facts in it. Some of the facts were corrected at the hold hearing, but there was a three-day trial with numerous witnesses in this case. If you look at the at Mr. Magnus's representation, I mean, this is at the hold hearing. You know, he argued, you know, extensively against the hold. He distinguished the case law on the hold. He talked about his completion of treatment. He talked about his supervision in the community. He talked about that these weren't, in fact, release violations, you know, once the sentence was overturned. So even at the hold hearing, I mean, he went to Mr. Urbanek's house to get additional treatment records from Mr. Urbanek because Mr. Urbanek obviously couldn't leave. He was on the hold order at the sex offender program. And then if you go to the trial itself, if you look at the transcript, there's just simply no ineffective assistance here. He was very well represented. This is a case where he had an examiner of his choice. One of the examiners did not support commitment of the three experts. He called in his, Mr. Magnus called in Mr. Urbanek's employer, he called in, or his ex-employer, he called in his treatment people. I think he called in three and only two ended up having to testify. But this is not a case where Mr. Magnus mailed it in at all. This is a case where Mr. Bannock got, he got effective assistance, and Mr. Magnus focused on the issues that Mr. Bannock had, which were the community issues and how important those contacts with minors or his use of marijuana, things like that were in the community. So that was all, you know, it was all, you know, hotly litigated, extensively litigated at the time of the trial. So for him to come now and say, oh, the records were obtained in the wrong county, I mean, that has nothing to do with whether there was appropriate subject matter jurisdiction or personal jurisdiction. And it has nothing to do with the timeliness of this. I mean, he, again, as Judge Larkin brought up, he brought this on his own over 12 years later. He could have brought up ineffective assistance if he thought he was not well represented at the time. He's filed various, you know, discharge proceedings. He knows how to get before a court. So it's late in the game to come, you know, at this point and raise all these technical errors that really don't go to whether or not he received due process in this criminal proceeding, because he did, from a court that had subject matter and personal jurisdiction over him. And to the extent that the issues, you know, that were raised with respect to the court-appointed examiner's reports or his questioning of witnesses, I mean, that is all hindsight on trial tactics and strategies, which this court pointed out in the Johnson case, is not something that we go back and look at 13, 14 years later. And, I mean, it's basically a critique. I mean, God forbid somebody goes back and looks at, you know, everything I've done 12 years ago, and if they would have done it differently, then critiques everything and says it was ineffective because of that. So I just think this is, it's improperly before this court, or it's improperly was before the court. The district court never should have said, I'm going to assume this is timely. It was over 12 years after the initial commitment. I mean, it was clearly not a timely Rule 60.02 motion. But once the court did assume it was timely, she did not abuse her discretion in her decisions about the order not being void and about counsel being effective in this case or not being ineffective in this case. I point out in my brief that, I mean, the trial court, even at the end of trial, you know, specifically brings up how well represented the clients were in the case with respect to, I guess, both attorneys, but that certainly indicates that Mr. Magnus was effectively represented his client and brought up the proper issues in that case. And I did want to bring up also, the Geem case does not say that it divests the court of subject matter jurisdiction. That's a case that talks about timing. It doesn't talk about subject matter jurisdiction. So, yes, the timing requirements have to be complied with, but certainly if a case is dismissed out, a petition is dismissed out because of a time violation, it could be rebrought. There have been cases, I think, where petitions have had to be filed 3 or 4 times because of time issues in the past. That doesn't happen so much now. But
Geem does not say statutory compliance on procedural issues in a sex offender commitment case are ones that divest a district court of subject matter jurisdiction.
That's correct.
And in fact, isn't Geem the case that says we need to stop calling everything that's an error one of subject matter jurisdiction?
That's correct. And we cite to that in our brief and say that it specifically says it doesn't divest the court. And none of the statutes, and this was not even a timeliness statute, the statutes being raised here are, it's a pre-petition statute that was before, they're all pre-petition statutes. So it would be even a better argument that there it doesn't affect whether or not there was subject matter jurisdiction in the case.
Because they don't concern any proceedings before the court.
Right, exactly. And I would note, too, and I mean, the court has the trial transcripts in the initial commitment trial case. And Mr. Magnus, and I don't have the page sites because it just came up, and I just wanted the court to be aware that if you look at his Mr. Magnus's cross of Dr. Linderman, he does bring up the fact that that conditional release, you know, that he wasn't on conditional release. You know, he shouldn't have been on conditional release at the time of those violations. So he does bring that up with her. I think the thing of it is, and not to get too much into the facts of the commitment, because I don't think at this point that that's really the relevant thing. But, I mean, he had some high-risk behavior well before 2002 when he was discharged from, or should have been discharged from conditional release. So I see that my time is up, so unless you have additional questions.
It appears we do not. Thank you.
I would just ask the court to affirm the district court order. Thank you.
All right. Ms. Avery, you have 5 minutes if you wish to use that time.
First of all, I'd like to just bring up the fact that under 253B.185, it absolutely does limit the right of a county to bring a motion for production of records to the county of the person's residence if they're not in prison. If you look at the subdivision one, it talks about that the attorney of that residence can determine good cause and file a petition. And then under 1B, it talks about that they have the right to make a motion for production of records to determine good cause. And those two attorneys are one and the same. It's not from Hubbard County then, or a different county. They also use the word the county attorney. They do not use a county attorney, any county attorney. They're referring back to the county of residence. I do want to touch now, too, on Mr. Bannock's lack of pre-petition screening. And by law, a pre-petition screening is required, and that is in the case In re Morton. That's been law for over 30 years. I also want to point out in the special rule number 8 that it requires that a petition be served on a respondent along with a summons and pre-petition screening report. It then excludes persons who are on judicial hold. And the reason it excludes them is because they're under 244.05 and they've received a pre-petition screening in prior to being referred to the court, and they've been notified up to a year in advance. It did not exclude Mr. Urbanic. And the respondent, she notified the court that one was not required for Mr. Urbanic because he was an SPP-SDP candidate. And she used those terms interchangeably, and generally they are, but in Mr. Urbanic's case, they were not. He was denied equal protection by not having a pre-petition screening, and every other candidate for SPP-SDP receives one. And in addition, when he was served with the petition, he was at home, and the sheriff came, or the police officer came and kicked in his door, handcuffed him, and physically took him into custody and gave him the petition. He never received a summons and a pre-petition screening report. And that did not give Otter Tail County personal jurisdiction to file it, to proceed with the civil commitment case on him. The petition was also not signed by people with, the 253B-185 requires that the petition be signed by somebody with knowledge of the facts. And clearly nobody had knowledge of the facts because it stated that he was a first degree offender, that he was on intensive supervised release, and that he had conditional release violations. And they did, in the hold hearing, talk about a few of these. They talked about that he was a second-degree offender, not a first. And they said, at this time, he is not under conditional release. But there's multiple times in the hold hearing where the respondent talked about that he was on intensive supervised release until March. And that was not true. So those things did not get corrected. They were only in the hold hearing. None of the witnesses were required to abide by any of those. The judge did not remember to put those in the hold order, that they had made those oral amendments, and they weren't complete anyway.
But then if there was a commitment trial and the judge made findings supporting commitment and there was an appeal and this court affirmed the commitment,
right,
why did those hold hearing errors matter 14 years later?
Because although Mr. Magnus did talk about these errors in court briefly, he never brought them to fruition in any of his documents. And so when he did this proposed findings of fact, he didn't mention any of this. And I do invite you to look at exhibit number 42 and say, would I want this person as my attorney? And I don't think he took the actions that a reasonable attorney would take for somebody who was about to lose his liberty and he was a free man. He had not violated his conditional release. There was no conditional release to violate. And even if there was a teenager that recanted her story. She lied. She told the court that he did not say these things. Why are they in the first place? They should not have been there. So the court, neither court had subject matter or personal jurisdiction. He did not receive due process. He did not get equal protection. And he received ineffective counsel. And for that reason, we asked the court to overturn the district court's order denying his motions. I do want to mention briefly, too, that we've been getting a lot of these cases that have been denied. And all these clients are not getting any assistance. And I can't tell you that they have a case or not. Mr. Urbanic could have been in that same pile of cases that said, hey, you've got no case. All you're alleging is your attorney used drugs. He would have been in that same pile because he didn't get... I can't tell you that those cases don't have merit as well. All I can tell you is that Mr. Urbanic's case does have merit, and he should not have been civilly committed. Thank you.
Thank you. The matter is submitted. We thank counsel for your briefing and argument. We'll issue our decision as required by our rules within 90 days. That is the end of our oral calendar this morning, so we are in recess. Thank you.